rally in Alaska. This will be a doozy. I hope you'll join me on YouTube, Twitch, and or Facebook. And otherwise,
we'll depose from the faint. Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
DJ Heim from Forest, and you're listening to 88.3 WRCT.
For those of you concerned with your health and the new USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all our DJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
My fellow Americans, I would just like to say now, as an expert on the subject, that WRCT Pittsburgh does not blow. Thank you.
WRCT in sound from way out.
RCT Pittsburgh, meaty and full of flavor since 1949.
Would you like to take the sounds of your favorite radio station to places you never thought possible? Well, now you can, because WRCT is live on the internet. Just point your browser to www.wrct.org and click on our live MP3 broadcast. Now you can go out of town without any feelings of loss or regret for leaving us behind, because we're just a mouse click away. WRCT, live on the internet. Because why should Pittsburgh have all the fun?
Depose from the faint. Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
Yo, what's up? How y'all doing out there in Technoland? RCT Techno DJs in the house. Oh yeah, bringing you the only fat beat.
And the new USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all our DJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
DJ Heim from Forest, and you're listening to 88.3 WRCT.
Hey there, folks. Glad you could join me for all the best, the smoothest of the smooth, the cool and gentle sounds of what we call jazz.
Tired of the fluffy stuff? At WRCT Pittsburgh, jazz is a one-syllable word.
Holocaust. It's a very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Now and forever.
Hey there, folks. Glad you could join me for all the best, the smoothest of the smooth, the cool and gentle sounds of what we call, jazz.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
We cannot accept that this violent act took place during an election, the foundation of democracy. In the strongest terms, I condemn this act.
Japan's former Prime Minister Shinzo Abe has been assassinated while giving a speech in Western Japan. We'll go to Tokyo to look at his death and legacy. Then the detained WNBA superstar Brittany Griner pleads guilty in a Russian court as pressure grows on the Biden administration to help secure her release.
I'm frustrated that 140 days have passed since my wife has been able to speak to me, to our family, and to her friends. I'm frustrated that my wife is not going to get justice.
Then we look at the killing of Al Jazeera reporter Shireen Abu Akleh in the occupied West Bank in May. This week, the U.S. State Department said she was likely killed by Israeli military gunfire, the conclusion of many news organizations, including the New York Times, the Washington Post, CNN. But the U.S. found her death was the result of tragic circumstances, not an intentional killing. The U.S. is being accused of helping Israel whitewash her death before Biden's visit. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Japan's former Prime Minister Shinzo Abe has been shot and killed by an assassin wielding what appeared to be a homemade gun. Abe was campaigning for a parliamentary election Friday morning in the city of Nara in central Japan when two shots rang out. Images of the attack's aftermath shows security officials tackling a man in a gray T-shirt. They later named the 41-year-old suspect as Tetsuya Yamagami, a former member of Japan's Maritime Self-Defense Force. Footage from the scene shows what appears to be an improvised double-barreled gun. Japan's strict gun control laws prevent almost everyone from possessing guns. In 2021, there were 10 shooting incidents in Japan, just one gun death. By comparison, the U.S. typically records 45,000 gun deaths each year. Shinzo Abe was airlifted to a nearby hospital with injuries to his neck and heart. He was pronounced dead earlier today from blood loss. He was 67 years old. Abe was Japan's longest-running prime minister when he stepped down in 2020, citing poor health. Over nearly 8 years in office, Abe remained pro-nuclear despite the 2011 Fukushima nuclear meltdown following an earthquake and tsunami. Throughout his career, Abe tried unsuccessfully to do away with Article 9 of Japan's peace constitution, which renounces war and bars Japan from using or threatening to use military force. We'll have more on Shinzo Abe's assassination and his legacy after headlines when we go to Japan. Ukraine's government says at least 4 people have been killed and several others wounded by Russian rocket fire in Kharkiv and Kramatorsk. Elsewhere, Russian warplanes bombed Snake Island early Thursday, just after Ukrainian troops landed on the Black Sea territory and hoisted blue and yellow Ukrainian flags to celebrate Russia's withdrawal from the island. In Moscow, President Vladimir Putin said Russia's military operation in Ukraine is yet to start in earnest, more than 130 days after he ordered Russia's military to invade.
Сегодня мы слышим...
We are hearing that they want to defeat us on the battlefield. What can I say? Let them try. We have often heard that the West wants to fight us until the last Ukrainian. It's a tragedy for the Ukrainian people, but it looks like it's heading in that direction. But everybody should know that, largely speaking, we haven't even yet started anything in earnest.
In Ukraine's capital, Kyiv, President Volodymyr Zelensky met Thursday with visiting U.S. Senators Lindsey Graham and Richard Blumenthal. The pair are promoting bipartisan legislation that would see the U.S. declare Russia a state sponsor of terrorism, joining a list that includes Cuba, Iran, North Korea, and Syria. Senator Blumenthal spoke to reporters after the meeting.
I was shaken to the bone at the soul-shattering sight of the mass graves at Bucha today and the photographs of innocent people with their hands tied behind their backs, slaughtered outside their homes, and the destruction of nursery schools and civilian targets, plainly innocent people killed. If that isn't terrorism, I don't know what is.
On Capitol Hill, progressive Democrats Mark Pocan and Barbara Lee have proposed slashing the Pentagon budget by $100 billion. Their proposed amendment to the National Defense Authorization Act comes after Democratic leaders agreed to add up to $45 billion to President Biden's already record-breaking request this year for $813 billion in military spending. Meanwhile, Public Citizen reports members of the House and Senate Armed Services Committees have received over $10 million in campaign contributions from weapons manufacturers during the 2022 election cycle. In Russia, WNBA star Brittany Griner has pleaded guilty to charges that could bring her up to 10 years in prison after officials found less than a gram of cannabis oil in her luggage as she passed through customs at a Moscow airport in February. Griner's Russian lawyer spoke to reporters outside a Moscow area courthouse Thursday.
Our defendant has pleaded guilty. She drew the court's attention to the fact that she did what she did inadvertently, without intent.
Brittany Griner's guilty plea added to speculation the U.S. may be negotiating her release as part of a prisoner swap with Russia. We'll have more on Brittany Griner's case later in the broadcast. President Biden signing an executive order today to protect abortion rights 2 weeks after the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade. The order directs Health and Human Services Secretary Javier Becerra to submit a report within 30 days on how to safeguard access to abortion medication and emergency contraception while maintaining patient privacy. Residents of Akron, Ohio, were ordered to spend another night under curfew Thursday as protesters continued to demand justice for Jayland Walker, the 25-year-old black man killed in a hail of police gunfire June 27th. Walker was unarmed when Akron police fired about 90 rounds at him after he tried to flee a traffic stop. His body was still handcuffed when it arrived at a coroner's office for an autopsy, which showed he was struck at least 60 times. On Thursday, Akron officers arrested prominent family members of police shooting victims and charged them with rioting. Bianca Austin is the aunt of Breonna Taylor, who was shot and killed by police officer Brett Hankison in her own home in Louisville, Kentucky in 2020. Also arrested was Jacob Blake Sr., whose son was left partially paralyzed after he was shot by police in Kenosha, Wisconsin in 2020.
To take a stand because enough is enough. If this was white America and a white boy had been shot 60 times by the police, it would go up in smoke. But because he's brown and looks like me, 60 shots, or what did he do to provoke? Nobody can provoke someone to shoot them 60 times. No one.
A federal judge has sentenced former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin to 21 years in prison for violating the civil rights of George Floyd. As part of a plea agreement, Chauvin also pleaded guilty to violating the civil rights of John Pope Jr., a black teen who was just 14 years old in 2017 when Chauvin grabbed him by the throat, hit him repeatedly in the head with a flashlight, and pressed his knee into the boy's neck while he was prone, handcuffed, and not resisting. Derek Chauvin will now be moved to a federal prison to serve his sentences concurrently with his 22-and-a-half-year sentence on state charges of murder and manslaughter for killing George Floyd in May of 2020. The Wisconsin Supreme Court is allowing sex trafficking survivor Crystal Kaiser to argue in court she was justified in killing her trafficker. The ruling argued a 2008 state law that protects trafficking survivors from criminal liability for any acts committed as a result of trafficking extends to first-degree murder. Crystal Kaiser is accused of killing her white sex trafficker, Randall Volar, in 2018. She was just 17 at the time. He'd abused her since she was 16. Court records show Kenosha police knew Volar had a history of sexually abusing underage black girls and was under investigation for sex trafficking, but he remained free 4 months. Kaiser says she shot and killed Volar in self-defense after he drugged her and tried to rape her. In Haiti, protesters took to the streets of Port-au-Prince Thursday, marking 1 year since the assassination of President Jovenel Moïse. People denounced Haiti's worsening political and economic crises since Moïse's killing and the lack of process in his murder investigation.
It seems many officials from the Justice Ministry are involved in the president's murder. We can't say who they are, but we're waiting for justice to be done. We're very worried since there are plenty of officials said to be involved in the murder.
In Texas, Republican Governor Greg Abbott has ordered state National Guard soldiers and state law enforcement officers to apprehend and expel asylum seekers who cross the U.S.-Mexico border, a move immigrant justice advocates have denounced as illegal. This comes as ProPublica and the Texas Tribune report the Justice Department is investigating alleged civil rights violations under Operation Lone Star, the multi-billion-dollar immigration and border crackdown ordered by Governor Abbott last year. The program has seen thousands of asylum seekers arrested and jailed, sometimes for weeks and often without charge. And California Governor Gavin Newsom has approved a budget that allocates some $100 million for the state to manufacture its own insulin at a cheaper price. This is in response to the skyrocketing costs for the life-saving medicine that have made it inaccessible to many diabetes patients. Governor Newsom made the announcement Thursday.
Nothing epitomizes market failures more than the cost of insulin. Many Americans experience out-of-pocket costs anywhere from $300 to $500 per month for this life-saving drug. California is now taking matters into our own hands. The budget I just signed sets aside $100 million so that we can contract to make our own insulin at a cheaper price, close to at cost, and to make it available to all.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We begin today's show in Japan, where Japan's former Prime Minister Shinzo Abe has been shot and killed by an assassin wielding what appeared to be a homemade gun. Abe was campaigning for a parliamentary election candidate Friday morning in the city of Nara in central Japan when two shots rang out. Images of the attack's aftermath show security officials tackling a man in a gray T-shirt. They later named the 41-year-old suspect as Tetsuya Yamagami, a former member of Japan's Maritime Self-Defense Force. Japan's Prime Minister Fumio Kishida condemned the killing as his voice cracked.
We cannot accept that this violent act took place during an election, the foundation of democracy. In the strongest terms, I condemn this act.
Footage from the scene of the assassination shows the assassin wielded what appears to be an improvised double-barreled gun. Japan's strict gun control laws prevent almost everyone from possessing guns. In 2021, there were 10 shooting incidents in Japan, just one gun death, while the U.S. typically records 45,000 gun deaths each year. Shinzo Abe was airlifted to a nearby hospital with injuries to his neck and heart. He was pronounced dead earlier today. He was 67 years old. Abe was Japan's longest-running prime minister when he stepped down in 2020, citing poor health. Over nearly 8 years in office, Abe remained pro-nuclear despite the 2011 Fukushima nuclear meltdown following an earthquake and tsunami. Throughout his career, Abe tried unsuccessfully to do away with Article 9 of Japan's peace constitution, which renounces war and bars Japan from using or threatening to use military force. We go now to Japan, where we're joined by Koichi Nakano. He is a professor at Seiya University in Tokyo. We last spoke to you in 2014 when we broadcast Democracy Now! From Japan. Welcome back to Democracy Now! Under extremely difficult circumstances. First, can you respond to the assassination of the longest-running prime minister in Japan's history, Shinzo Abe?
Hi, Amy. Well, of course, everybody was caught by utter surprise, and of course, we are all appalled and in shock. Of course, gun violence is an extreme rarity in Japan in itself, but also the you know, the fact that this took place against a sitting member of the parliament and the former prime minister with a lot of influence over the government policy even today, and the fact that this happened during the campaign as he was making a speech in favor of a candidate of his own party exposed the vulnerability of the politicians and the candidates during the time of the election in particular. Mr. Abe is not an ordinary candidate. Well, he wasn't running. He was just cheering for another candidate from his party. But of course, he was escorted by a group of security police, which is not usually the case with the other candidates or politicians in the electoral campaign. So this is something that I think we are still sort of trying to figure out and understand how this happened.
Right. High officials said he had the absolute highest security. But guns are such a rarity in Japan. I mean, the picture of this gun, it looks like two pipes that are gaffer taped together. And it looks like the assassin who they tackled was a member of the maritime forces of Japan in the, you know, maybe 20 years ago. Can you explain what that is? And that goes to the issue of what one of the reasons Prime Minister Abe was so controversial as he tried to change the peace constitution of Japan.
Right. So, yes, I mean, we still don't know in great details, and maybe we'll never fully understand what was the motive behind the killing. What we do know is that the man used to serve in the Maritime Self-Defense Force, which is Japan's equivalent to the Navy, although, of course, Japan, by according to the Constitution, as Amy explained earlier on, Article 9 stipulates that Japan from banning war potential, and therefore it is strictly supposed to be for individual self-defense. Mr. Abe has controversially lifted the ban on collective self-defense in 2015, but of course the man was serving in the self-defense force way before that, and according to the reports, he seemed to have served for 3 years, and he has left the self-defense force long since. So we still don't know whether there is any kind of meaningful connection between his experience and the crime that he committed today. So I think at this point, it's very difficult to make the connection, though, of course, you know, maybe it is related, but we just don't know yet.
And the significance of what Abe was trying to do, what he never succeeded in doing. Ultimately, he stepped down both times he was prime minister because of what? Health reasons, right? He has ulcerative colitis, some kind of or something like that. But right. He attempted to do this. Now, this is the U.S. written Japanese constitution after World War II. But it was, I think, with some officials in the U.S. government's attempt also supporting Abe in removing that from the Constitution.
Right. And in fact, Mr. Abe tried to sort of overcome what he saw as the constraint, unreasonable constraint in his view of Article 9 on Japan's self-defense capabilities by taking two different routes. One was, of course, to seek to formally revise the Constitution, which he never got around to do. And in fact, it is somewhat ironic that he was at the heart of the LDP ruling party's campaign to try to sort of secure a two-third majority in this upper house election so that the parties in favor of revising Article 9 would have enough seats to instigate a national referendum to that effect. And a central sort of pillar of the proposal was to include the term self-defense force into Article 9, as Mr. Abe claimed that in the absence of such stipulation, self-defense force was suffering from the lack of legitimacy. an argument that many people in Japan were not quite convinced, because a lot of people in Japan accept the existence of a self-defense force as long as it's within the boundaries of Article 9, concentrating on narrow individual self-defense and spending most of the time in efforts to rebuild and rescue at the time of disasters. But having failed to do that, Mr. Abe has even more controversially has taken the shortcut, and instead of formally revising Article 9, he has resorted to government offering a reinterpretation of the same text of the article. And so this happened in July 2014, exactly around the time when Amy had a chance to visit Tokyo at the time, and Japan at the time, and subsequently also passing legislation that enabled the government to exercise collective self-defense. Mm. So in that sense, I guess he left somewhat frustrated, but at the same time, he has pushed through a fundamental change in Japanese national security posture of the called post-war.
You know, we're showing images of Prime Minister Abe with President Obama. He stood with President Obama at Hiroshima, President Obama, the first American president to go to Hiroshima, the U.S. dropping the nuclear bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and they stood together at Pearl Harbor.
That's right. That's right. And well, in terms of gun violence, even though it is a rarity, in fact, the mayor of the city of Nagasaki, well, two different mayors of the city of Nagasaki have been shot, and one died consequently out of gun shooting. And so in that sense, you know, it's a rarity, but it's not entirely unheard of. And it usually is committed, a crime that is committed by the right wing or by Yakuza mobsters.
When we were in Tokyo broadcasting from there, I remember the major protests around nuclear power because of the Fukushima nuclear meltdown. Abe was well known at the time. He was prime minister for supporting nuclear power. Horrifically ironic, the head doctor at NADA, where he was brought at the Medical University Hospital, his name is Dr. Fukushima. But the significance of Abe's pro-nuclear stance.
Right. So I guess one of the missions that Abe embraced was to try to push back nuclear power generation on its track after he took power back from the Democratic Party of Japan government between 2009 and 2012, which happened at the time of the Fukushima disaster. And while the party that was in government at the time has since tried to steer away Japan from nuclear power generation, the ruling, today's ruling LDP from Abe's time onward have made significant efforts to restart nuclear power plants or try to sort of regain legitimacy to nuclear power, but with only very limited degree of success so far.
Professor Nakano, you wrote a piece that was headlined, "The Leader Who Was Trump Before Trump." I mean, this was a few years ago. It was an op-ed piece in the New York Times. Explain.
Right. So this was actually kind of a intended praise by Steve Bannon that Mr. Abe was Trump before Trump. And, Bannon is not the only person to take that view either. Mr. Abe returned to power in December 2012, campaigning on the slogan, "Taking Back Japan," which finds, of course, later resonation with "Make America Great Again" slogan of Mr. Trump. And the two famously got along, or Mr. Abe went a long way to please Donald Trump. I guess he really prioritized the cordial relationship between him and the president of the U.S., be it Obama or Trump, so that Japan can strengthen its alliance with the United States. Under the name of the rule of law and the defense of the liberal order worldwide, it is ironic that in an attempt to do so, as I mentioned before, he ignored the constitutional constraints and reinterpreted the Article 9 to fit his purposes. And so even though he's regarded sometimes by the West and by the American opinion leaders quite often that he's the champion of the liberal democratic world and a great statesman, domestically, he's been a much more controversial figure, as divisive as Mr. Trump in many ways. And the liberal left has been looking at him as the person who really put the endangered liberal democracy as we know it today, in terms of suppressing press freedom, in terms of suppressing academic freedom, and also ignoring the constitutional rules, and also often stepping away from accountability in the national diet, which is our parliament.
Finally, the implications of Abe's assassination. Are you concerned that this will push Japan to the right?
Yes. In fact, that would be something that I think many of us on the liberal left of the political spectrum are worried about at this moment. Of course, you know, this has been an attack. This is an attack on democracy, not so much because Mr. Abe was a champion of democracy in Japan in itself, but rather because this is struck at the heart of the democratic process when the election campaign was at its fullest operation. And the voting day is only there are only one day left. It's going to be on Sunday. So tomorrow, Saturday, would be the last day of campaigning. But now the television is airing continuously rather sycophantic tributes to Mr. Abe, ignoring the fact that he was rather a controversial figure. And I guess it's hard to sort of be critical of him openly at a time like this when he died a tragic death. But even though the television has been rather muted until today, because they've been sort of trying to keep the balance or trying to sort of not offend the government by too aggressively reporting on the past policy failures and scandals, now the media looks like it's almost hijacked by LDP government's record in a very analyzed or not so much analyzed in a positive way. So this would quite possibly lead to a landslide victory by the ruling LDP and its allies on Sunday, which might in fact hand them a sort of a, you know, a blank check that they will be able to utilize for the next years to come.
Koichi Nakano, we thank you for being with us, professor at Sophia University in Tokyo, director of the Institute of Global Concern at Sophia. Next up, the jailed WNBA superstar Brittany Griner pleads guilty in a Russian court. She was carrying cannabis oil in her luggage in Russia as pressure grows on the Biden administration to help secure her release. We'll get an update. Stay with us.
Thank you.
Evening Wind by the Japanese composer Joe Hisaishi. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman, as we turn now to the growing push to free the U.S. basketball superstar, Brittney Griner, from detention in Russia, amidst concerns her case could drag on due to her fame and also her status as an African-American lesbian. In an effort to clear a deal for her release, Brittney Griner pleaded guilty Thursday in a Russian court to what her lawyers say are trumped-up charges of large-scale drug possession and drug smuggling. This comes after Russian officials at the airport arrested the two-time U.S. Olympic basketball gold medalist and eight-time WNBA All-Star in February at a Moscow airport, alleging they found two vape cartridges containing cannabis oil in her luggage. She just arrived on a flight from New York to play for a basketball team in Russia, which nearly half of professional U.S. players do in order to supplement their income, since the WNBA's maximum salary is capped at just under $230,000, the WNBA women's basketball. Griner's trial began last week. Russian officials have said they will only negotiate in her case after the trial is over. Brittney Griner told the court through an interpreter she had no intention of committing a crime, had acted unintentionally because she'd packed her luggage in a hurry. Griner still faces conviction and sentencing and is set to appear in court again next Thursday. As Brittney Griner was escorted to the courtroom in handcuffs, she held a photo of her wife, Sherelle. This is Sherelle Griner speaking Wednesday at a Bring BG Home rally on the home court of the Phoenix Mercury, Griner's team in the U.S.
What and how I feel today is a deeper emotion than hurt. I'm frustrated. I'm frustrated that 140 days have passed since my wife has been able to speak to me, to our family, and to her friends. I'm frustrated that my wife is not going to get justice. I know you all are frustrated, too. That's why you're here. This easily could be any one of us. So tonight, I ask for your help in continuing to fight for BG's safe and quick return home. Let's make sure this administration knows that they have our support to do whatever is necessary and that we are not going to ever be quiet until she's home safely.
This week, President Biden and Vice President Harris spoke with Sherelle Griner in their first one-to-one contact after Brittney Griner wrote a letter to Biden pleading for him not to forget about her. The call came more than 2 weeks after the State Department botched a plan to have the couple speak by phone on their fourth wedding anniversary. The White House press secretary, Karine Jean-Pierre, was asked about Griner's case Thursday.
We believe that the Russian Federation is holding, has wrongfully detained Brittney Griner, and she is in intolerable circumstances right now. And we are going to do everything that we can. The president has this top of mind to make sure that we get Brittney home safely, and also Paul Whelan. That is an important priority of the president.
In April, Russia released Trevor Reed, a former U.S. Marine, as part of a prisoner exchange after Thursday's court appearance by Griner. The WNBA Players Association said in a statement it stands with Brittney Griner. Griner also got support from the U.S. women's soccer star Megan Rapinoe Thursday during the Presidential Medal of Freedom ceremony at the White House. As Rapinoe received the award, she wore a white blazer with the initials BG embroidered on her lapel alongside stitched flowers. Rapinoe shared the image online, writing, quote, "The most important part of today, BG, we love you." For more, we're joined by two guests. Dave Zirin is host of Edge of Sports podcast, sports editor for The Nation, where his recent article is headlined, "Brittney Griner's Show Trial Begins." Also with us, Maya Goldberg-Safer, co-director of the Third Coast International Audio Festival, a writer who's been following Brittney's case closely. Her latest article is headlined, "Brittney Griner and the Labyrinth of Wrongful Detainment." We welcome you both to Democracy Now! First, let's start with Maya. Your response to this trial and the trial's end with Brittney pleading guilty, right, to these carrying these vape cartridges of cannabis oil, which would not be illegal in the United States, and what this means.
Thank you, Amy. So first, I think it's incredibly important every time we talk about Brittany Griner's case to first talk about the big issues at play here and be really blunt about it. She is wrongfully detained. It's been 141 days. And what that means is that this case is political. This is not about justice. This is a case that is decided from above the court, from powers that be. The outcome of this trial is going to be whatever outcome is most favorable to Russia right now and the demands that they're making on the U.S. And one of the ways that we know that this is a wrongful detainment is because these charges are very clearly trumped up. You mentioned that the charge she is facing for up to 10 years in prison is large-scale possession of cannabis and drug trafficking. And the prosecution themselves have reported that they had found a fraction of a gram of cannabis in her luggage. How is 10 years in prison a deserved sentence? So it's really clear here that the legal system is actually being used as a weapon of the state. And this is actually a state-sponsored hostage situation. And as you said, the guilty plea could be a strategic move in an attempt to hasten the negotiations between the U.S. and Russia. What we know is that no matter what, the outcome will be political, not legal. Dave Zirin, you've long written that she is a political prisoner. The U.S. State Department said that she is being wrongfully detained. Can you talk also both response to what's happening now, Sherelle and the family thinking that her case was not top priority? I mean, you have this failed call that was supposed to go through, set up by the U.S. Embassy, but they didn't staff the phones, so Brittany called it 21 times, and Sherelle didn't get that call. Finally, you get Brittany Griner begging President Biden in a personal letter that was handed to him, saying that she is terrified she will be in Russia for the rest of her life. Talk about the significance of all of this and also the possible prisoner exchange.
Absolutely. Let's talk about both of those things. First of all, credit to Maya, who's been on this story from the beginning. I think what we have to understand, Amy, is that the sports world, there were two wings when Brittany Griner was first found to be effectively disappeared by the Russian criminal justice system. There was a wing that loved Brittany Griner so much around the WNBA and basketball circles more generally, that they listened to the State Department give them awful advice to just be quiet for months, to not only not say a word, but to tell others to be quiet. I mean, I spoke to so many people in and around the WNBA who wanted to comment about Brittany, to call for her to come home, but were told that silence was the best option for a negotiation. It clearly was not. And then there's another wing of the sports world that did not love Brittany Griner nearly enough. And I'm talking about the mainstream sports world that would have raised heaven and hell to the earth if it had been, say, a Tom Brady or a Steph Curry who was behind bars facing 10 years in a Russian prison. And that reveals the tremendous and deep-rooted sexism and homophobia inside mainstream sports media. Now, you asked about the idea of a prisoner exchange. I mean, the name that's been floated greatly is a man named Victor Bout, who is an arms dealer in U.S. custody, who has the nickname in U.S. circles as the Merchant of Death, which is ironic because that phrase Merchant of Death actually comes to describe its roots are in U.S. arm manufacturers from the 1930s. Now, Victor Bout, this should be an easy—
I think it's Victor Boot.
Boot, I'm sorry. I'm sorry about that. The issue with Victor Boot is that there are people in the Biden administration who think that that trade is actually too much for Brittany Griner and are trying to slow that idea. But I think one of the reasons they're trying to slow it is that Victor Boot was an arms dealer for the United States and for U.S. client states and played a big role in the era after 9/11 in terms of transporting army contractors into the Middle East. So perhaps they don't want him out speaking about what he knows. But to me, this would be an easy decision in terms of trading Victor Boot and getting Brittany Griner home. But like I said, there are conflicts in the Biden administration about whether they want to do that.
And so the significance, Maya, of who exactly Brittany Griner is, her power in sports right now, she herself, and you talked about this in our previous conversation, wrote a book about her own life, Life Out Loud, as an athlete, as a lesbian.
so many years, what, more than 8 years now, because of the lack of pay equity.
Brittany Griner is truly a trailblazer in sports, and I think that her story oftentimes goes overlooked. She was the first openly gay number one draft pick in the WNBA in 2013, and she really changed the game. She fundamentally changed the way that the league relates to its queer players and fans, coaches, and I think she has made an incredible impact on sports. Now, as she is being detained, I think we can't separate this case from the Russian war in Ukraine or from the fact that she is a Black lesbian being held by a prominently anti-gay regime. And she faces dangers and I think has a specific target on her back because of that. And we see this, I think, when we see her paraded through the courthouse with multiple guards. There was a police dog at one point, handcuffed. And we also see this in even the U.S. media coverage that is really narrowing in on the possibility of her guilt or hashing out the alleged crimes according to Russian media, reprinting their claims. I think this is not a fair or safe position for Brittany Griner to be in. And what is most important, and what's most important for U.S. reporting as well, is to upfront talk about the fact that she is wrongfully detained and that what is most important in this situation when someone is being held hostage by a state in order to extract demands from the U.S., to extract concessions, is that the government do everything in its power to bring her home. And like Dave mentioned, when there is the possibility of a prisoner exchange on the table, but we know that there are people in D.C. who are opposed on principle and in policy, an informal policy opposed to that kind of prisoner exchange, we have to wonder, are they really doing everything they can to bring Americans wrongfully detained home, or are they actually holding up this process and contributing to the detainment of more than 60 Americans who are wrongfully detained right now around the world?
Griner's detention again in Russia linked to this issue of pay equity, which came up Thursday when Megan Rapinoe became the first soccer player to receive the Presidential Medal of Freedom, a longtime member of U.S. Women's National Soccer Team, who helped it win two Olympic medals and two World Cup championships. She also joined with other members of the team in suing the U.S. Soccer Federation for gender discrimination in pay, medical care and workload, leading to a landmark $24 million settlement in February in the Federation. Pledged to give the women's national soccer team equal pay to the men's team in all games and tournaments, including the World Cup. The U.S. women's soccer team has won four World Cup titles, while the men's team has won none. Now, keep in mind, Rapinoe is where.
I don't know if you're going to find room. 32 Olympic and World Championship medals. At age 25, the youngest person ever to receive the Medal of Freedom. The youngest ever.
Simone Biles has also spoken out about mental health and sexual assault. And as part of a group of some 90 women, including her U.S. fellow Olympic teammates, who've sued the FBI for $1 billion in damages over its mishandled investigation into sexual abuse by the former U.S. Olympic team Dr. Larry Nassar, who's behind bars now. Most of the women say he abused them after he'd already been reported to the FBI in 2015. Dave Zirin, you also have been following Simone Biles and the women's gymnastics team for years. Talk about the significance of this. I mean, Simone Biles, how important it is she is recognized, and at the same time, she has this massive lawsuit against the FBI.
Well, first and foremost, for folks who don't know, Simone Biles is the greatest athlete of her generation and in the discussion for the greatest athlete of the last century. She does things in gymnastics that other people simply do not do. She has moves named after her that other people simply do not do. She is beyond the parameters of the sport itself. That being said, she's also a person of profound principle. And I really do believe from everything I know about Simone Biles, she would give up that congressional medal. Give up that congressional medal that she received, or the presidential, I'm sorry, that she received in a heartbeat, if it would mean that the Justice Department would do its job and actually go after the members of the FBI who let Larry Nassar perform acts of sexual abuse and sexual assault with impunity. That's what the U.S. gymnastics women want. They want justice, and they're...
And we will continue to cover that case as well. Dave Zirin, we thank you for being with us, sports editor for The Nation magazine, host of the Edge of Sports podcast, and Maya Goldberg-Safer, author of the new article in The Defector, headlined Brittany Griner and the Labyrinth of Wrongful Detainment. We will link to both your articles. Coming up, the United States is being accused of helping Israel whitewash the death of Al Jazeera reporter Shireen Abu Akleh, shot dead in the occupied West Bank in May as the Israeli military raided the Jenin refugee camp. Stay with us.
The news is in from Palestine. Shireen. Israeli military raiding Jenin. Shireen. Protective vest and helmet clearly said press. Sniper gonna send a message to the rest. Written on your face with a vicious deadliness. Shireen. Shot the nation, yelled they're shooting to kill. Shireen. Well, that's nothing new, it's the IDF drill, Shireen. Israel said it wasn't their fault. Must have been the crossfire in which you got caught. A human rights lesson IDF taught, Shireen.
Shireen by the singer-songwriter Tom Nielsen. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As President Biden prepares to visit Israel in the occupied West Bank, the United States is facing accusations it's whitewashing the killing of Palestinian-American journalist Shireen Abu Akleh. On Monday, the State Department announced it had concluded the bullet that killed Shireen likely came from Israeli military gunfire, but stopped short of saying investigators had reached a definitive conclusion in her killing. The State Department also said her death was not an intentional killing, but the result of, quote, tragic circumstances. Shireen Abu Akleh was shot in the head May 11th. As she reported for Al Jazeera on an Israeli army raid in the occupied West Bank of the Jenin refugee camp, even as she wore a flak jacket and helmet, clearly marked press, Palestinian groups and several media organizations, including CNN, The New York Times, Al Jazeera, have determined Abu Akleh was killed by Israel's military. So is the Israeli human rights group B'Tselem, which accused the Biden administration of whitewashing her death. Shireen Abu Akleh's niece, Lina Abu Akleh, responded to the State Department's findings Monday.
We were expecting that such an investigation would actually hold the perpetrators accountable and would carry out a transparent investigation that is free from any political pressure. However, that was not the case. We will continue to call for justice. We will continue to call on the U.S. to carry out a transparent investigation by an independent body. In addition, we continue to call on the U.N. and the ICC to carry out an investigation and hold Israel accountable and put an end to this grotesque impunity that Israel continues to endure.
We're joined now by the Dutch Palestinian analyst Moin Rabbani, who is co-editor of the online journal Jadalia and hosts the Connections podcast. He's former senior analyst, Middle East, and special advisor on Israel-Palestine with the International Crisis Group. Moin, thank you for joining. But it comes to the issue of accountability, not to mention they're coming after the New York Times, CNN, a number of news organizations, and the Israeli human rights group, B'Tselem, have said that this was Israeli gunfire.
Yes. I mean, the significance of the U.S. so-called investigation is not what they found, but what they chose not to find. In my view, it was a foregone conclusion that the U.S. would find a way to give Israel a pass on the summary execution of the legendary Palestinian journalist, Palestinian-American journalist, I should add, Shirin Abu Akleh. And what this report has basically done is say, you know, it's likely that it was this, but the only definitive conclusion that we can reach was that this was not an intentional act and the result of tragic circumstances. In other words, what the U.S. has done is attempt to throw sufficient doubt on the facts of the case and thereby ensure that Israel will not be held accountable for its actions with respect to the murder of Shirin Abu Akleh. And I think that's the long and short of it. And I think I would also add that anyone who expected a serious investigation of this case has an at best limited understanding of U.S.-Israeli relations, because, again, in my view, it was always a foregone conclusion that the U.S. government would put Israel's political interests ahead of justice and accountability for a murdered U.S. citizen who is also a Palestinian journalist.
On Tuesday, AP reporter Matthew Lee questioned State Department spokesperson Ned Price. This begins with the State Department spokesperson, Price.
Given the totality of circumstances, given the totality of facts that became available and that were made available to the U.S. Security Coordinator and his team, they found no reason to believe that it was an intentional killing, but rather the result of tragic circumstances in the course of a raid.
Okay, and then how did they come to a determination that there was that they could not conclude that there was intent or a lack of intent? And how did they come to a conclusion that it was, I mean, they basically didn't come to any conclusion.
What they right? did, what, okay, but, what,
and so, can you explain how it is that you're able to say that there's no evidence of intent, no matter who did the shooting?
Right. Well, that's exactly what they find, what they found, or precisely what they didn't
find. Isn't that finding, exactly, finding nothing.
Well, they found no reason to believe this was intentional.
Didn't find any reason that it wasn't intentional.
Again, the totality of the circumstances, based on the two investigations to which they were granted access, based on the site visit to the site of Ms. Abu Akleh's death, led them to the conclusion that this was the result of tragic circumstances during this IDF-led operation.
So, Moin Rabbani, if you can respond to this. And also, I mean, you also had the funeral for Shireen attacked by the Israeli military, where the casket almost fell to the ground as the pallbearers were attacked.
Pallbearers were physically assaulted by Israeli police and security forces during the funeral of Shirin Abu Akleh in East Jerusalem. It was just one of
a number of incidents by the Israeli forces on the day of her funeral. I should add, Matthew Lee has been on the State Department's case and its prevarications when it comes to matters Israeli-Palestinian for years. So all credit to him for following this one as well. But I mean, can one imagine Ned Price responding similarly if a Ukrainian-American journalist had been shot by a Russian military sniper in eastern Ukraine? It's just inconceivable. And again, what is happening here is the U.S. is making very clear that the only definitive conclusion they can reach is that Israel is essentially innocent of the murder of a U.S. citizen. And you know, that's the outrage, but that's also the nature of U.S.-Israeli and U.S.-Palestinian relations and U.S.-Middle East policy.
So talk about the upcoming visit of President Biden to Israel and to the occupied territories and the significance of this, how what they're saying about Shireen Abu Akleh plays into this.
Well, as the political analyst and writer Trita Parsi recently wrote, when it comes to the Middle East, Biden's first term is, for all intents and purposes, identical to Trump's second term. And certainly when it comes to this issue, the Biden administration's what Anthony Blinken and other U.S. officials told the Palestinian leadership is that unless you hand over the bullet that killed Shireen Abu Akleh and allow us to put this matter to rest by essentially saying that no conclusion can be reached, we're not going to throw you the bone of a presidential visit to the Palestinian Authority leadership. And that's essentially what happened.
Muin, I wanted to get your response to what's happening now. On Wednesday, the Israeli military conducted large-scale raids across occupied West Bank, detaining at least 42 Palestinians, shooting dead a 20-year-old man named Rafiq Riyad Ghanem during a raid in the village of Jabba near Jenin. This coming just 3 days after the Israeli military shot dead 18-year-old Palestinian Kamel Awana in the same village. These are the areas that Shireen covered for so long in these kinds of actions.
Yes, I mean, you know, it's par for the course. You cannot have a military occupation without consistent, violent repression to maintain that occupation. It's, you know, history over the past few thousand years demonstrates that conclusively. And what you have here is the Israelis focusing in particular on the northern West Bank and Jenin and its environs, because that is an area that is under somewhat less firm control of the Palestinian Authority and its security forces, who have been working very hard to ensure peace and quiet for the maintenance of the Israeli occupation. And it's in that context that you're seeing these constant raids. And it's quite likely also that the murder of Shireen Abu Akleh was in part to scare off the media from that area so that Israel could have a freer hand in conducting the kinds of activities that you just mentioned.
Well, Muin Rabbani, we want to thank you for being with us. Of course, we'll continue to cover this issue. Dutch-Palestinian analyst, co-editor of Jadalia. He's also hosts the Connections podcast. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Produced with Renee Fels, Mike Burke, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warnoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff. I'm Amy Goodman. Stay safe.
You are tuned in to WRCT Pittsburgh, broadcasting at 88.3 FM from the beautiful campus of Carnegie Mellon University.
You're a man without truth, a man of greed, a man of hate, a man of envy and doubt. You're a man without a soul. All the money in the world will never fill that hole. You're a man bought and sold. You're a man without a soul. Save face, your man without a soul. How do you think this story ends? It's not a matter of how, it's just a matter of when. 'Cause it's coming down. Yeah, it's coming down. Darkness all around you to cover all your hiding. There's no light in your eyes. You're a man without a soul. Now the exits will be closing. The sad life will be exposed. No dealer and no deals, 'cause you're a man without a soul. How do you think this story ends? It's not a matter of how, it's just a matter of when. 'Cause it's coming down. Yeah.